Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. And today we're devoting our entire show to bring you part one of our candidate forum for the folks running in El Cajon City Council's District 4 elections. Welcome, everyone, to our East County Magazine Candidate Forum for El Cajon's District 4. District 4 is the south-central portion of the city under the newly created districts. There are four candidates on your ballot. Three of them are here tonight, and it's my pleasure to welcome Councilman Phil Ortiz, Fair Housing Advocate Estela de los Rios, and Dunya Shaba, a professor and former defense contractor in Iraq. The fourth candidate is Billy Thigpen, and he actually informed us yesterday that he is suspending his candidacy, and he has actually endorsed Ms. De Los Rios. So congratulations on that, Estela.
Thank you.
We thank all of our candidates for participating, the members of the public who sent in some great questions, and the Facebook Journalism Project for underwriting our series of virtual candidate forums in this era of COVID-19 when we are not able to hold live forums. I also want to welcome our producer, John Sepulveda, who will also be our timekeeper. John, we couldn't do this without you, so thanks so much. Even though you're out of town and on vacation, we appreciate you calling in and helping us out on this.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Great. Yeah, El Cajon is the Valley of Opportunity, and so we're very excited to hear from these three candidates about their ideas for a better El Cajon. And so without further ado, let's move to opening statements. Each candidate will have 2 minutes to tell us all about yourselves, your qualifications and accomplishments, and what you hope to do to accomplish if you are elected. Let's start with Councilman Ortiz, the incumbent.
Thanks, Miriam, and thanks again for hosting this. You're the only news outlet that's doing it for our smaller district election, so I really appreciate the time and effort you guys are putting in, especially with your staff, too. So my name is Phil Ortiz. I'm a city councilman here in El Cajon. I was appointed to my seat in El Cajon about a year and a half ago. East County native. I'm a small business owner as well. I own a company that does evaluations to see how energy efficient your home is, lowering people's electricity bills and being good stewards of the environment. My priorities for El Cajon, as they've been since I've been about a year on the city council, are public safety. We want to make sure that when you call for help, there's trained professionals that answer quickly and they get to you quickly as well. Homelessness, it's no secret that El Cajon has its fair share of people suffering from homelessness in our city, so we want to do our best to partner with nonprofits and help get them back into housing and lift them up out of their situation. And financial stability. We got to make sure that the city's paying its bills on time, that we're not running up a credit card, and we're being responsible with our citizens' taxpayer money. I have two children, a three-year-old and a brand-new five-month-old. I live with my wife, Rachel. My son's name is Wesley, and my daughter's name is Jolene. I just want to thank you again for hearing me out.
Well, thank you very much. It's our pleasure to do this. We know that during COVID, it's tough for candidates to get out there and campaign the way that you normally would, or even the precinct walkers to walk around door to door. So we felt this is an important service to provide. Estela, let's hear from you next. And by the way, we will be rotating the answers so everybody will get a chance to be first, last, and in the middle. Estela de los Rios, let's hear from you.
First of all, thank you very much, Miriam, for this opportunity. I've been following all your forums, and I'm really excited that you've been doing this. My name is Estela de los Rios. I'm currently the executive director of a fair housing agency, but I'm also a longtime resident of El Cajon, 40 years plus. I have three daughters, all went to Grossmont High, to El Cajon School District, and now I currently have five grandchildren who are also enrolled in our school district here in El Cajon. As a community member for 40 years, I know the issues of housing and other issues that are facing residents. I am focused on the homeless situation. I know that this is a priority for many, but Also a pressing and important issue for myself. Affordable housing is another concern. The rents are exorbitantly high, and our seniors can't afford them with fixed incomes. El Cajon has a huge low to moderate income population, and we need to build more affordable housing units. It could increase housing for the homeless as well, and also increase economic growth. My other issue is public safety, which is a critical time at this time in our nation, specifically here in El Cajon. Presently, there's a lack of confidence and a lack of trust with community, and that needs to be restored. We need a public safety program that invests not to harm the community, but to protect and serve. Having 30 years of management, and after earning my BA in sociology from SDSU, I'm ready to extend my services to the city. My experience as a board member in multiple agencies around the county, locally, state, and nationally, I believe I have the experience to allow me to serve El Cajon residents. I have established networks that have addressed victims of human trafficking, hate crimes, and fair housing violations. And I'm very active in the community. I'm the president of the San Diego Fair Housing Alliance Board. I'm secretary for Latinos and Latinas Acción. Also board member of Justice Overcoming Boundaries, board member of Lemon Grove Thrive, East County Justice Coalition, and a member of National Fair Housing Alliance and a national member of World Without Exploitation. I also serve as a chair for the Welcome Newcomer Network of El Cajon, which addresses immigrant and refugee issues. And I've been recognized by several organizations, but the one that I'm most proud of is I've been chosen one out of 50 Latinos whose portrait hangs in the San Diego History Center. And I presently am excited because I serve now as a commissioner for the Leon L. Williams San Diego County Human Relations Commission 2020. And lastly, I don't know if I mean, have any minutes left, but I strongly believe in respect.
John, let us know if we're getting close on time.
Okay. I strongly believe in respect, dignity, and human rights for all people, regardless of their race, age, language, national origin, religion, sexual orientation, and disability. So thank you very much again for the opportunity, and I look forward to this forum tonight.
Very good. Thank you so much, Estella. And Dunya Shaba, let's hear your opening remarks, please.
Good evening, everybody. First of all, thank you, Mariam, for allowing me to come aboard and be part of this and meet the other candidates because I never met them before. So I welcome you guys, and thank you for allowing me to be here. To give a little bit of background about myself, I'm originally from Iraq. I came when I was 13 years old. I came to the United States. I survived the Gulf War in Iraq. I came in here. I attended high school. I've been resident of El Cajon 30 plus years. I attended Valhalla High School. I graduated from San Diego State. I have a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. I finished 2 years police academy here at Grossmont College. I finished master's in politics, emphasized on international conflict resolution. I finished another master's in higher education as a professor. I'm in the final phase of getting my dissertation and a PhD in higher management and leadership of higher education. I served in the military as a DOD contractor. I was a culture advisor for General Petraeus for about 5 years in Iraq. Part of that duty taught me how to do a lot of planning and future planning and operations and so forth. I learned a lot through the military. I became in charge of a program, rehabilitation program, inside a prison system in Iraq. I trained the Iraqi Special Forces as well, along with the U.S. Army. Then I came back here. I went to Middle East in the Gulf area. I was able to renovate private schools. I was first to open higher education college in southern Iraq. I promote education. I also did a lot of work while I was here. I did work for SART as a SART advocate for crime prevention. I worked for the hotline when I was in the school. So I was able to meet a lot of our victims in the community here and worked hand in hand working with them on how to get them situated, how to put them through rehab programs, and how what needs that they needed. I also ran for a parliament member in Iraq, but I withdrew myself. I won a vote over there, but I withdrew myself because the corruptions that they were facing. So I just came back as of August of last year. I came back, I obtained all these degrees, and I speak four languages. I have a son and a granddaughter who's also in the El Cajon school district. My main goal here is to target not just homelessness and the housing increase, because I saw a difference between me traveling back and forth. I see there's a lot of changes here in the community. We need to promote more of a customer service, community relations, along with law enforcement. We have a higher Chaldean community in the area that we are in. And those Chaldeans are not, some of them, they need to be educated. So I'm promoting education as well, along with following law and order pretty much. And those are my primary goals right now. So, and promote education as well. I want to make sure that we promote education to a certain point so we can go internationally with other Europe and Middle East. I have traveled as well to 50 countries, got to see a lot of educational procedures along Europe, Middle East, and so forth. So I have a lot of educational background, and I have 17 years of management experience.
Wow. Thank you very much. And I think the people of El Cajon are actually very fortunate to have three obviously very experienced and well-qualified candidates running for this position. Let's start with our first round of questions. I'd like to ask first about the topic that's been so much in the news lately, which is racial justice and policing. El Cajon, like many cities across the U.S., has had recent protests over racial justice and policing issues. So I would like to ask each of you, what are your ideas for balancing concerns over racial injustices and police funding concerns versus the concerns by others over making sure that we have adequate police protection to control crime and protect the community? And on this one, Estella, your turn to go first.
Thank you, Anne. I believe this is an issue that urgently needs attention. Just yesterday, I participated in a memorial for Alfred Alongo, who 4 years ago was unfortunately killed on Broadway. And public safety is critical, especially because we can't continue to turn a blind eye or our backs on these life-ending events by the police, law enforcement. I would like to implement a mental health response team and create a community oversight committee. There is a PERT team, but it needs improvement because it's not functioning to the needs of the community. From what I understand, they have a long wait until they respond. And I believe that law enforcement needs more training in communication and mental health assessment. The community oversight committee would address the responsibility and accountability of law enforcement, and that's something that we can create as a community. There needs to be communication in order for the community to work together with law enforcement. I think that that would be the best interest for everyone's public safety. When I was out walking in the community, this was an issue that concerned everyone because they were very distrusting. They don't want to call the police department. They don't want to, be involved in anything. They're very fearful because of what happened 4 years ago, traumatized El Cajon, and there needs to be a change. At one time, there was a chief advisory board, which I served on. We only met maybe like twice. But I think that was a good start, but I would definitely create an open communication with community and law enforcement. That's crucial in order for community to trust again. And I believe this is not just a local issue, but a national issue as well, since everyone is very aware of knowing all the killings across the nation with the injustices. When you mention racial injustice, unfortunately that occurs now. There's a history, there's a pattern, there's inequities in social justice, and this is something that I'm very committed to, I'm very passionate about, and I will be addressing it. So thank you. That's a very good question.
Thank you very much. Junya, let's hear from you on the issue of racial justice and policing.
That's one of the things. Graduating from a law enforcement police academy of 2 years here in El Cajon, that was over 12, 13 years ago. The standards were different. Standards to become a police officer has differentiated through time. I believe that the law enforcement, a lot of the community here, they don't know what's their rights and what their constitutional rights are is, and what can they practice, what can they do. So a lot of the community, as stated, they get scared of calling the police department. They get scared that, you know, they're going to be arrested. They're going to be, so there's a lot of crimes that's been committed here, especially domestic violence issue here with the community, the Chaldean community that I face. There's a lot of domestic violence issues where parents are scared. They think if they call the police that they're going to get arrested, they're going to lose their kids. So, on the other hand, it's a two-way street. The police department as well, there is not ongoing training. There is not, back in the days, they used to do a lot of community service and community relations where, you know, DARE programs would see DARE programs in the schools where they, you know, conduct a lot of programs for the children. I don't see that as much. I don't see that there is a lot of interaction between the law enforcement as well as the community here. And I'm targeting toward creating more programs, awareness program, as well as giving knowledge and education to those community about what constitutional rights they have, what can they do, what can they not do. And at the same time, we need ongoing training for the police officers, especially the new ones that are graduate. They come and they become on the field, and you see a lot of them are not well experienced as the previous officers been, or those who have been on the field for many years. So I'd like to target those two things.
Thank you very much. And Councilman Ortiz, your views on racial justice and policing, please.
Thank you. This is a serious topic, and it's swept across our country, and it's not something I think anyone takes lightly. First, I want to address, you know, some of the issues that I hear people saying aren't really the same issues that we experience in a small town, and I think we need to make that distinction. We have a small town compared to large municipalities like the NYPD, Chicago PD, LAPD, where their budget is in the billions and our budget is a lot less than that. And so while some of those criticisms may be true, it might not apply to our city. We really don't have over-policing in our city. I'm looking at our call logs and our calls for service. Sometimes we're two, maybe three calls in the queue behind. So I think any kind of action is going to need to push towards funding our police, whether that be in training, whether that be in more programming. I would love to have more of our officers be bilingual, especially for our Middle Eastern population. I know education is a huge thing on that. I was part of the leadership program through the East County Chamber of Commerce leadership program, and we were working on a program to get basic teaching newcomers what 911 is meant for. So our officers and our fire department, our paramedics are available for them. So the second thing is I think our leadership in El Cajon right now has a focus on community policing. Mike Murphy is our sergeant and actually the president of our Police Officers Association union. And he was in the news recently about two young kids doing graffiti on a wall that wasn't theirs. And he rolled and caught them. And instead of handing them a ticket, he sat and he talked to them. And he listened to what they were saying. They wanted to get their views out. So he said, made a deal with them saying, if you come back with me tomorrow and help me clean up the graffiti and paint over it, I will find you a place to paint and get your message out. So now we have this beautiful mural making its way around El Cajon. This was right after the one of the shootings that happened. That's just one example of how our leadership is impressing upon our younger officers and on the city on how to handle situations where maybe a ticket isn't really needed. Maybe just their voice needs to be heard. So I think it's serious. I think training's needed. I would agree with, I say, both of my opponents here that programs are needed and getting out to the communities to establish trust is important.
Thank you very much. Let's do a quick one-minute question here, but because these are district elections, and the whole point of going to districts is so that the needs of each individual part of the city can be represented by that, whoever the winner is. So I would like to ask each of you how long you've lived in District 4, and do you have any specific priorities for your section of the city? Dunya, you're first.
I've been in this district for, I say, 15 to 17 years, and then I lived on the other side of, I think, District 2 mm-hmm. for the remaining of the year here. So I've been here 30 plus years. My main concern is our main street and Mollison, where I live. It became a very high crime rate here on Mollison and Main Street. We have a lot of homelessness. So these are my two main streets that I'm targeting.
Very good. Thank you. Phil, what would you do specifically for District 4?
Yeah, so when I'm talking to my neighbors and myself, I'm on Washington, and I know street racing is always a topic, even on the ancillary streets, not even Chase, Washington, Avocado coming down. Street racing is an issue. Even the people on the ancillary streets, it's a big problem. There was even one of my friends who's a teacher in the school district had a car go into her brother's car, and he was in the hospital. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So we designated funding to do patrols for street racing. And a lot of these people who are street racing, they don't live in the city. They don't live in the district. They don't live anywhere near here. They come in here. It's straight away. So it wakes up my daughter when she's taking naps. So that's one thing that I hear and that I experience frequently is street racing. Homelessness, obviously, is a big issue that we need to continue to address. But the one that's not heard a lot, but that I hear frequently when I'm talking to my neighbors is street racing is a big problem.
Yeah, so I'd like to hear a lot about that too. Well, yeah. And briefly, how long have you lived in the district, Bill?
Oh, sorry, about 3 years.
Okay, great. Estella, how about you? Your priorities for District 4, sorry.
Yes, and I've been living in the district for 40 years, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And constantly, I'm going to say it again, homelessness. And for years, I've been advocating models around the country that have worked. Some in New York, Safe Haven, and Eugene, Oregon. And finally, 3 weeks ago, the city council approved some tiny homes, if they call it, which is at Meridian Church. And this was a model that is successful. And I would implement also an outreach team that would go out for assessing and fund this, you know, through the city. Because many of our homeless populations, they have mental issues and they have substance abuse issues. I see this all over and, in my district, on Main, and everywhere that you drive around in our fourth district. Yeah. And even when I come to work, I think they need a holistic approach, which means addressing food, shelter, medical resources, and a training program to prepare them for independence, to be independent. I participated in the East County Homeless Task Force, which everyone knows there's a regional one, but I think there's a lot of resources, a lot of organizations that are concerned that we can build a model in order to serve our homeless population and create more of a cleaner environment, because it does affect the cleanliness of our city. I've heard this over and over, just by looking at our streets and seeing them full of homelessness, you know, that doesn't look good. It reflects on our city and our city needs and what we're avoiding, and we're ignoring it. We just can't sweep it under the rug and pretend the homelessness is just going to go away, because they're here and we need to address it. And again, you know, I know this is an issue that we've talked about, but it's in my district and I want to see it, you know, I want to see some remedies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You kind of jumped in and answered my next question, which is about homelessness, but I'm going to actually combine two questions here, I think, so Estella will have a little more to talk about maybe. Homelessness, of course, is a very major issue in El Cajon, and to the city's credit, they have spent more money than other East County cities to try to address the problem, and yet they still have the highest number of homeless people of the cities in East County. So I would like to ask each of you, if you haven't already addressed it, your approach to get help for the homeless while also protecting the residents and businesses from issues caused by homelessness. And in addition, I'm going to throw in that the city currently funds, you know, short-term 30-day housing or so for the homeless at the East County Transitional Living Center, which does a great job for what it is, but to get the long-term privately funded help over there, like job training, that's really only open on a faith-based, you know, basis for people of the Christian faith. So I also wanted to ask, when you address your homelessness approach, do you think the city should try to establish an independent long-term program similar to that, but that is not faith-based and is open to everybody in the city, whether you're of any faith or no faith at all, I guess. And Phil, it's your turn to go first on this one.
Great. Yeah. So Since it's two questions, do we have 4 hours to answer this question?
Well, I think a good 2 minutes anyway on this.
This is a complicated issue, and it is the thing that I think about the most. I mean, like I said, I have homeless people that have slept on my doorstep that I haven't been able to get out of my home. So it's impacting me directly. It's personal. And I think the model that we need to continue to adopt is to partner with nonprofit organizations that have been in have the experience of solving homelessness for decades, instead of the city creating its own department and trying to figure out how to solve homelessness. I think any time that we partner with a nonprofit, they're going to be able to utilize the funding a lot more effectively. They're going to be able to harness the power of volunteers, which the city can't do. So I think that's the model that we need to continue to go after. And the tiny house program that we partnered recently with Meridian Baptist, that was sponsored by myself and Councilman Steve Goble. And so I know that there's been criticism with the city and they're not doing enough. I mean, I'm doing my best to try anything. And if an organization wants to come into, you know, any part of East County and use their resources and time, talent, and treasure to come in and solve homelessness and help people overcome their mental poverty, their addiction, I'm all for it. You know, there's plenty of homeless people out there to help. Come on in. We're more than happy to. I am a little worried that other cities aren't helping as much as we are. The city spent over $640,000 on homeless programs given to nonprofit organizations. And I have a concern about our citizens, where we may be becoming a magnet because we have so many services here. So we need to keep an eye on that. And that's not to say we should stop, but we just need to keep an eye on that. I mean, all that to say, I think that this county and the state need to also help as well. We've done a great job. We did the Way Back Home program with Salvation Army, getting housing for 86 individuals at a cost less than $240 per person. So we have this population that we were helping. The next population that we need to address have the severe drug addiction and mental health issues, and that's going to cost a lot of money. And small budget cities can't address this on their own. The state had mental health facilities in the 80s, the 60s and 70s. They were taken out in the 80s. Look at 1 to 2 generations later, we have hundreds of people on our streets with severe mental health issues. So we need to partner and petition to the county and to the state and to other cities to help us out. I think El Cajon's doing a good job. We've spent the most out of any city in San Diego other than the city of San Diego. Am I up time?
I think we are. Okay. John, are we at time? Okay, thank you. Estella, go ahead and let's hear some more from you on the issue of homelessness.
As I said before about the model, and first of all, I believe it's our city's responsibility. We have enough taxes. You know, I'm pretty sure that looking at the budget, we can allocate to make that a priority. I do know about CDBG because I've been receiving those funds. Right now, there's Secure Act funding for emergency funds for due to COVID. There's some funds there. And one thing I want to bring up, you mentioned the transitional living. I know that some of them have requirements, but I believe that should not be a requirement. I believe homelessness should be addressed regardless you know, of requirements. If you're homeless and you have some needs, mental or whatever that is, you should be assisted. I believe that there's a lot of blighted areas. I want to touch on that. A lot of empty lots, in fact, there's one here in the corner of my home and around the corner from my work where homeless they live there and they reside there and the owners do not take responsibility. One particular building, and I can go on and on, they just don't care. And that I've been told that they've been reported to the city and the city turns a blind eye and says, you know, we've already contacted the owner, but owners need to be accountable for those blighted areas. They need to be sent a letter and be fined if they don't, you know, either knock the building down and build a new one or make use of that building, because it's a good hub for our homelessness to be there and create more of an uncleanliness city. And I believe that if those blighted areas were addressed, they could become, you know, a development for housing. So I think it's our responsibility as citizens I do believe we pay a lot of taxes. I remember there, at one point, we were the highest tax city. And there are funds to address the homelessness. Other cities have done it. Why can't we do it?
Okay, thank you. Dunya, what is your approach to homelessness?
If my opponent, Phil, wants 4 hours, we need months for this to target this issue.
I know.
This issue of homelessness is not just homelessness. It's the crime related to the homelessness. It's the drug issue, the drug addiction. It's the increase of housing rental. There's a lot of issues that are related to this homelessness. One of the things that I did is, I've been doing for many times, is I take my granddaughter and we go to homelessness, to homeless on the street, and I sit with them and I talk to them and I help them. Some of them, I ask them, I have approached them, why are you homeless? I had a lady who said that, you know, it's during COVID-19 that there is shelter available. However, we get scared. We don't want to get affected by Corona. I had other individual who complained about the hours, how they treat them at the shelter, saying that there's curfew time and that they cannot do they cannot leave after curfew and they have to be there certain hours. So all these needs to be reassessed. There's, from me working with my background, working as an advocate in the past, there's a lot of programs that United States offers. They have more opportunity here than they have in Middle East or in any other countries. So we have a lot of programs. We have budget dedicated for that program. But my priority is to make sure that these are being assessed correctly. The procedures of the shelters and, you know, like holding them for 30 days and there is no long term, what they're going to do after that? Where are they going to go? Salvation mm-hmm. Army, where they host people who leave jails, you know, they host them for a certain period of time for rehabilitation. And then after that, there's no long term. There's no job qualification for them. A lot of them have criminal records. They have a felony. They can't get a job. So they ended up on the street. I had a lady who, she lives in an apartment and she said she was going to go homeless next month because of the increase of the rent. Another thing that I really want to target is making sure that we need to reassess who's taken Section 8, who's taken HUD programs, who's qualifying for these. There's a lot of people who are overqualified that are continue on getting these help. There's people that I know personally that they make a lot of money, yet they don't report that money. They're still on Section 8. They're still taking low-income apartments. They hold on to it until they save their money to buy houses. So we need to reassess that. That's Thank one you. Thing that is very important. We need to reassess. And another thing is maybe utilize other cities' budget because they don't have so much homeless issue.
We're at time, Dunya. So if I want to remind everybody to watch over there, and our timekeeper, John, will let you know when you're getting close or when you're at time, and we'll let you finish the sentence, but we want to try to get as much in as we can. But you will have closing statements, or if you use less time on a future question, you can, you know, use that to expand on something earlier. Let's move on and talk about some business issues. The pandemic has taken a big toll on the economy locally and really across the country. I would like to know what each of you would do to try to attract more business and commerce to bring jobs and revenue to El Cajon. Estella, you're first on this one.
Okay, and you're absolutely right. COVID-19 has turned the world upside down and it has affected every household in America, mm-hmm. let alone residents have been traumatized, businesses have been shut down. And it's impacted everyone. And I believe that, you know, first of all, as a city, we should follow precautions on CDC guidelines. It's a humane issue and it's a health issue, besides being an economic issue as well. I know that the city has placed into order Secures Act funding to help the renters program. I think that with the same funds, we can help some of those businesses, because those businesses are surviving right now. And I know that it's important to keep those businesses open. So I would fund some businesses to stay open, get some remedies keep them, have their doors open, mm-hmm. because we don't know when this pandemic is going to go away. I don't think anyone knows.
I just want to jump in and say, I did have a question later about, you know, how we should use CARES Act funds. But this specific question was about any ideas for attracting new revenues for the city beyond helping the existing businesses that we have. So sorry, I should have clarified that up front.
Okay. Well, I believe there is new revenues. We just have to look at the budget, allocate where the needs are, and Right now, you're right. The needs are in the businesses, and I support commerce, and I would like to see the city have more economic growth. So I would support bailing out some of these businesses so that they can stay open.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Dunya, you're next.
One of the things that I really would like to see is assessing the unemployment benefits for those small business owners. A lot of them, even though that they're allowed to open their businesses and resume their work, they decide to close down and then they collect the unemployment. So we need to reassess on that. We need to promote and allocate budget for independent individual who finish education and then utilize their degree toward investing something into the city.
Okay, thank you. Phil, your ideas for attracting new revenues to El Cajon or helping businesses, I guess we'll make it kind of general here. jumping in on that.
Yeah, no worries. So to bring in new revenues, the first thing you have to do is listen to businesses and listen to developers and listen to people who want to open businesses and ask them, what's stopping you from opening up in El Cajon? And then from there, we move forward with, do we need to change regulations? Do we need to alter this policy or just make it easier at City Hall? We've been doing that at City Hall for as long as I've been there, which isn't that long, a year and a half, but I know they've been doing it there for a long time. We have the lowest impact fees, developer fees in the county to make it easy for people to build those commercial developments and mixed use where it's commercial space on the bottom and then apartments up top. El Cajon has been designated by Governor Newsom as an opportunity zone. And so there's huge tax breaks for businesses to come in and develop land. That's a massive opportunity. We're one of two areas in San Diego. So I'll answer the CARES funding later, but that's how we do it.
Very good. Thank you so much. Moving on. Parkway Plaza, our regional shopping mall in El Cajon, recently sold to a new owner who has announced that they want to eliminate the regional shopping mall to build housing and office space, but that would require the approval of the city council. I know I talked to at least one council member who had some real concerns about that and wasn't so sure the council would do it. Do you believe it should be kept as a shopping mall or torn down and replaced with housing or offices, or that some compromise should be forged, that the city should insist that the new owners maybe allow for some housing on a portion of that large property, but require that, you know, maybe add adding a second story or using maybe one piece of the property for that, but insisting that they retain the shopping mall for the convenience of the residences and frankly, the sales tax that brings into the city. Dunya, I believe it's your turn to go. Did I get that mixed up? I think it's Dunya's turn to go first. Go ahead.
I smiled because when I grew up here, I worked as a security in Parkway Plaza for Westfield Shopping. So that was part of my job working here at the mall while I was in school. Parkway Plaza is a very, very nice shopping mall. And a lot of people in the community here, they like to go shopping. You know, this is one way of venting out, especially right now what we have with COVID. There are so much limited in the activities. So people, my son is one of them. Every time he's bored, he goes to the shopping mall, you know, when they open up, if there's certain stores that are open. So I'm totally against tearing it down and building housing. There's a lot of lands. There's a lot of other opportunities that they can do. We only have this mall here in El Cajon City, and this has been going on since I grew up here. And, you know, I'm totally against the idea of tearing it down.
Okay, thank you very much. Phil, you're next.
Thanks. So that's a very complicated issue. I think you have to listen and watch and evaluate what is happening at Parkway Plaza. If it turns out in a year, 2 years, 5 years that it's a ghost town and businesses aren't moving into those spots in the mall, then that's not helping anybody. It's not providing a service for our residents. It's not providing sales tax for the city so we can turn that into services for our citizens. So we need to stop and evaluate and determine based off of evidence what's the best use for that property. I'm not totally opposed to having it be mixed use and having apartments above the mall. My wife goes there. She takes my son there all the time. It's the last owner did a great job after Westfield left it. You know, there was leaks in the leaks in the roof, so they did a great job. So there's a lot of land there. I think we need to keep watching it and determine what needs to be done based off of the evidence of it.
Okay, Estella, your thoughts on the future of Parkway Plaza?
I do not want to see Parkway Plaza torn down. It's ironic that we just spoke about businesses. We just spoke about economic growth. So where do you balance that? I mean, we're going to tear down all these businesses? Doesn't make sense. These are businesses that are successful, have been successful. And I believe that it is a landmark of El Cajon. You know, everyone mentioned their children go, you know, I think there used to be a merry-go-round. I'm not sure if it's still there. I remember taking my children to the merry-go-round.
It's gone, unfortunately. You know, my kids loved it too.
Yeah. It's good for the city. It's good for the morale. It brings revenue to the city. It's economic growth. You know, there is plenty of room for affordable housing in other places in El Cajon. I just mentioned all the blighted areas we have. I welcome developers. Make some more affordable housing. That's one of my priorities as well. But don't knock something down. If it's working, why knock it down? Why, you know, tear down some economic growth that we already have? We already have businesses there. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, and I would throw in on that it seems to me that the current, I would say that the immediate past owner during the pandemic, just as a point of information, wasn't really doing anything to promote the businesses that were there. We actually reached out to them and asked them, said we want to do a story about what's still open at the mall and what's not, because people were confused. And their answer was to send us a list of all the tenants and say we should contact each one individually. I think they could have done better. So my first personal two cents worth is that, you know, maybe before they tear it down, you know, a little more could be done in a post-pandemic.
They collect rent on time and they impose punishment and late fees. I'm sure they know who's open and who's not.
Yeah, I would have thought so. Moving on to housing, which each of you has touched on a little bit, but California and the county face a shortage of housing, especially affordable housing. SANDAG and the state have mandates now for cities on this. What steps specifically do you support to increase housing availability, especially affordable housing, while, you know, protecting the character of communities and, you know, other things that are important? And Phil, it's your turn to go first on this one.
Great. Thank you. No problem. So with regard to housing, there was a study that was done in 2016 for the San Diego area by Point Loma University. And it attributed 40% of the cost of housing is attributed to regulations. So I'm not saying we need to roll back everything right away, but if we want to look at the incremental cost of housing and why it's so expensive, we have to look at regulation. And that's something we've done in El Cajon, is we've gone to the developers, people building homes, and saying, how can we make it more efficient for you to build? What can we get through the pipeline faster, because time is money for them. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is we've done as much as we can in the city. There's not a lot of land left in the city to develop. There's a big spot over by the trolley, the MTS station. There's a huge parking lot. We're working with MTS to secure that for apartments, low-income apartments. It's right next to transit. It's convenient for people. And it's a lot of underutilized space in the city. We just finished the project for homeless, for veterans, low-income veterans, right in city center, right off of Main Street. So I think we're doing a good job. It's really difficult to hit our RENA numbers that the county and the state put on us, just because of the lack of real land that's in the city.
Okay. Thank you very much, Phil. Estella, your thoughts on housing?
And thank you, because every day we receive calls, overwhelming calls, about the exorbitant rents. And these are calls coming from low to moderate income populations, as I mentioned earlier. We have a lot of seniors here, a lot of mobile home parks here, a lot of veterans here. We have a tremendous need for more units. I believe other cities have more affordable housing complexes than we do. And this has been an issue and a concern of mine for many years. So I believe it would increase revenue, as we mentioned a little while ago, the economic growth. And it helps some of our homeless, because a lot of these transitional housing are short-term shelters. We don't have any shelters. I think, you know, we don't have abundance of them. And we can, you know, developers are always seeking building locations to build. I remember when we had the condominium units going up a couple of years ago, there was overwhelming support for that. And I think that affordable housing is something that needs to be done, especially because of the rents are so high and we don't have rent control. We need rent stabilization, and I believe affordable housing would be close to it.
Thank you. Dunya, your views on housing and affordability.
I totally would, first of all, regulate new laws that between tenants and landlord. There's a lot of discrimination between the two, and there's a lot of landlords take advantage of certain things that they have. So that's one thing. Second of all, decrease the housing rental here through, you know, through programs, needs, and other priorities. One of the things that I mentioned earlier is plan and assess new people who are getting the low income, the HUD programs, the Section 8. There's a lot of people who leaves the city, leave the state actually, goes to another state. So they don't want to be put on 15 years, 16 years waiting list for Section 8. Grab the Section 8 from a different state and then come back here after a year. And that's an issue. That's an issue that we face, and we need to assess that. We want to make sure that the people here who have children, who are single parents, who are senior, they have more priorities than other people who have been here for, you know, for a couple years, who goes to a different state and come back with a Section 8. I totally with that, that we need to do a new laws with the landlords, you know, because a lot of landlords also take advantage, especially now during COVID-19. I know that President Trump had mentioned, you know, don't take rent. There's no eviction notices. A lot of them violated that. A lot of them, they closed businesses down just because they couldn't afford to pay the rent. So we need to impose more laws on this. And that's okay. my priority.
Very good. Thank you. I'm going to combine a couple of questions here from readers. We had some people who were concerned about landlords in El Cajon that they say have been forcing new tenants to bear high costs of treatments for things like bed bugs, roaches, and mold that come back after the landlord has like treated this when they put it on the market. And then, you know, suddenly the problem comes back a month after the tenants move in without addressing underlying problems like maybe water leaks that might be causing that mold. So I had two related questions on this. I'll throw them both in here. Would you support any kind of law to require landlords to guarantee, say, 6 months of habitable living conditions and bear the cost of remediation if a problem they treated, you know, before it went on the market or up for rent comes back? And do you support hiring more code enforcement officers to address these kinds of problems? Or do you have other ideas for how this issue should be addressed? And Stella, it's your turn to lead off.
Thank you. That's a very good question, concern, issue, the way you formatted it.
Thanks. Hope it wasn't too complicated. But.
Yeah. There is a lot of inhabitability issues. I cannot begin to even go on about the mold and the bed bugs and everything that we talked about. We had homes that were had holes in the roofs, and it was raining, and they'd get their house flooded. That's how bad it is. We only have two code enforcement officers. We had one probably until about 3 years ago. And for the population of our city, we need to hire more code enforcement because it is an issue. These are old buildings, old apartments. We get calls all the time. Landlords, you know, they would like assistance with this, but if there's no code enforcement officers to go out there and assess and see what they need, then, you know, we can't assist those households. Tenants have to bear the cost. That's not appropriate. That's not fair because a lot of them are low income. I believe there should be an ordinance to hold landlords accountable, at least for the first 6 months. And then after that, you know, would be the tenant's responsibility because it's an open communication. It's, you know, their shelter. And I believe that it should be addressed because it's a health issue as well as a housing issue.
Okay, thank you, Estella. Dunya, what are your views on this issue of
I totally agree with my opponent. And just to add on, there's a lot of cockroaches issues as well. The city of El Cajon have older buildings. You know, they built in the 1950s and the 1960s. So there's a lot of landlord that refuses to remodel. A lot of landlord, they refuse to treat cockroaches. I have family members who complained to housing authorities, and the housing authority, they take the complaint, and a year, 2 years later, they respond with, you know, let's take them to civil suit, or you can do this and you can do that in a legal matter, but nothing's been resolved. I know that one issue we had a lot of cockroaches where they infested the whole apartment. They were inside walls, and housing authority sent a representative. He just looked at it, filled the report. The tenant weren't even allowed to obtain a copy of that report. They didn't even know what's their next procedures. So there is a lack of procedure and guidance with this. And I totally believe that we need to promote future planning, future assessment of what we're going to do. And they need all to work hand in hand. There is a lot of programs. Like I said, the housing authority should step up and do a little bit more work. That's what I believe.
Thank you, Dunya. And Phil, what are your views about how to address this habitability issue?
Yeah, so quick story. When I was in college, I rented half of a garage for $550 a month as housing. So I know what it's like to have habitability issues. The city has an apartment inspection program where we're cracking down on slumlords for safety issues. I mean, some of the reports I've seen from our inspectors, and we do have more, we have a handful of inspectors. I don't know how many we have, but it's more than one. But this is no hot water running, holes through walls where rodents can get through. And so we're cracking down electrical issues. We're cracking down on it. We also have a hotel motel program where we're enforcing basic habitability standards. So we're taking it seriously. Secondly, landlords have to be responsible for their own property. That's a full stop there. If the tenant did damages to it, then they have to pay for that. But if you have mites and bugs and all this, then that's completely on the property owner to maintain their property in a livable standard. And then also, I'm going to work on having anonymous reporting. So if a tenant has a bad living environment, you can anonymously report it to the city, and the city can send one of our code enforcement people out and do an inspection. We contract with Estella, CSA for housing rights, with her program, CSA, and they do a phenomenal job. That's another example of how nonprofits can do more than the city. All that to say, I've been one of those tenants that want to report, you're afraid of reprisal. You're afraid of someone coming back at you. And so the anonymous reporting, I think, is a fantastic idea that I'm working with the city manager on right now.
Very good. Thanks to all of you for addressing that. I think the next question we can probably wrap up in a minute here. But the city, you know, I think did a great thing in getting, after 10 years, the East County Performing Arts Center reopened as the Magnolia Center under the management of Live Nation, the biggest concert promoter in the world. And unfortunately, the pandemic hit, you know, not long after they reopened, and we don't know when they're going to be able to go back to doing concerts. So the question is, will each of you commit to continue civic support of the Magnolia whenever live shows are allowed to resume, and to work with Live Nation to make sure we don't lose this community resource? Dunya, it's your turn to go first.
When you mentioned Magnolia, I remember the old days when they used to do every year the cultural diversity of the food and the way they dress up and they come down, and I was part of that as well. I'm totally with keeping the Civic Center, because I think that's what holds our city. That's the... I will call it the pole of our city, because a lot of youth individuals, as well as older individuals who are from different diversity, different culture background, they like to go there, and this is what gets them excited. So I'm totally with keeping it, and not only keeping it, but also putting more creative ideas and investing more on this.
Very good. Thank you, Dunya. Phil, let's hear from you on the future of the Magnolia, or the Performing Arts Center.
The Magnolia is a fantastic asset for the city and a resource. I used to watch my brother perform there when he was in high school, when it was called ECPAC. Mm-hmm. And I have fond memories of being there. Yes, we need to continue to make sure that the Magnolia is the staple of our downtown area. When I have a bachelor's in criminal justice and a master's in public administration. Whenever you're revitalizing a downtown area, you need what's called an anchor, some staple that's going to draw people there. And the Magnolia is our anchor for the downtown area. And it's going to allow other businesses to thrive. It's going to allow other business, other development, restaurants and things like that to open up. You look at an example like in La Mesa. 10 years ago, it was Antique Row. It was sleepy and it had a chance of dying. But the city made a concerted effort to make walkability, parking easier. That's exactly what we've done with downtown El Cajon and even an enhancement with the Magnolia. So it's when you increase patronage, when you increase walkability, when you increase people buying things, it cuts down on crime passively. Mm-hmm. It cuts down on homeless encampments. This is public administration 101. And so it's a great resource. It was bringing revenue in within 4 months. I mean, and we were projecting for it to be at a loss for a year. So it was projecting revenue after a year, we got it in 4 months. And so the need's there, the desire's there. It's a great partner with Live Nation. We got two hotels coming in where people can stay. So I think it's a great resource.
Thank you. And Estella, let's hear from you about the future of the Performing Arts Center.
Absolutely. It is fine arts. It's a landmark for me that I've been here so many years. My daughter used to dance there, perform there with CYT. We had, you know, there was a lot of venues there and the venues were great. Before the pandemic started, I think, you know, we're a very diverse city and it brings very diverse entertainment. Thank you, Dunya, for reminding me of the International Festival. That was so much fun. We had all kinds of cultural entertainment and everyone just had a great time. And I think this kind of replaces that because we don't have that anymore. But I definitely think it brings revenue. It brings, you know, family fun and it encourages our fine arts because we have to respect our fine arts here in our city and all of our talents that we have.
That's great to hear. I think we all have that in common, a love for the Performing Arts Center. I certainly remember my own daughter when she was a little girl. They put ice on the stage 1 year, Tech Ice, and she got to go out there and do jumps on the ice, which was, you know, a highlight for everybody. Now, listeners, we'll be back with part two of this candidate forum for El Cajon District 4 candidates on Monday at 5 p.m. In part two, they'll be talking about issues including COVID-19, how to spend any future CARES Act funding, and budget priorities for the city of El Cajon. Or you can catch the entire thing on our website at eastcountymagazine.org, where we have videos of not only this candidate forum, but six others that we did at the top races across East County. And if you're not yet registered to vote, this is certainly one of the most important elections nationally and locally in a long time. You can go to sdvote.com, the San Diego County Registrar Voters site, to check on your registration. If you're not yet registered, you can register to vote. You can also find lists of places that you can do early voting or drop off your mail-in ballots or where you can vote in person for up to 4 days this election because of COVID-19.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producers, John Sepulveda and Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.